Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In Islam and the Devotional Object, Seeing Religion in Egypt and Syria, Richard McGregor offers a history of Islamic practice through the aesthetic reception of medieval religious objects. Elaborate parades in Cairo and Damascus included decorated objects of great value, destined for Mecca and Medina. Among these were the precious dress sewn yearly for the Kaaba, and large colorful sedans mounted on camels, which mysteriously completed the Hajj without carrying a single passenger. Along with the brisk trade in Islamic relics, these objects and the variety of contested meanings attached to them constituted material practices of religion that persisted into the colonial era, but were suppressed in the 20th century. McGregor here recovers the biographies of religious objects, including relics, banners, public texts, and coverings for the Kaaba. Reconstructing the pre-modern visual culture of Islamic Egypt and Syria, he follows the shifting meanings attached to objects of devotion, as well as the contingent nature of religious practice and experience. In our conversation, we discuss aesthetic theory, material culture, processional objects, museum exhibition, relic typologies, devotional objects and religious landscapes, public celebrations, visual text and its illegibility, and the function of banners. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now my conversation with Richard McGregor on Islam and the Devotional Object, Seeing Religion in Egypt and Syria, published with Cambridge University Press in 2020. Welcome, Richard. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Great, thanks. Happy to be here.
So very excited to talk about this really interesting book and quite beautiful. I'm glad you got it with a publisher that replicated all these images that you have. So it's a really nice book to even look at. But before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit about your journey in Islamic studies? Were there moments or mentors that were influential in bringing to the study of Islam and Muslims to Egypt or Syria, or the types of approaches that you take, what kind of structured the scholar you are today?
Sure thing. Yeah, well, my own development, I guess, and research trajectory began as an undergraduate or even in high school, I think, where when I became enamored with the idea, with the question of a comparative religion. So back in the day, this was a hot topic, and it was the paradigm, or it was the sort of big question, big puzzle that guided, I think, my choices in education, and guided my development, certainly in the earliest phases. I ended up specializing in religious studies at University of Toronto, and went on to McGill University. Further focused on Islam, the Islamic tradition, and in particular Sufism, Islamic thought, Islamic philosophy, and focusing on Egypt and Syria. So I became a lover of the Mamluk world. I was lucky enough to also do a 2-year postdoc in Cairo at the French Archaeological Institute, which was for me a wonderful point in my development as a researcher. And sort of my big guiding, you know, questions, something that I've returned to repeatedly is the paradigm that I've come to explore under the title of aesthetics, right? So, and I mean aesthetics in this more recent conception of what is aesthetics, right? I mean, aesthetics used to be this fairly narrow branch of philosophy that explored the beautiful, quote unquote. But in our sort of more contemporary usage in the modern period, aesthetics stopped being exclusively about the beautiful, and in some ways stopped being about art to the exclusion of other objects and images in the world. And aesthetics, so aesthetics widened out as a discursive paradigm. And for myself, aesthetics and the questions of object and image, the relationship of ideas to objects, has been a central thread in my study of religion and my study of medieval Islam.
Now, this particular book takes this idea of the object and the visual kind of front and center. So can you tell us a little bit about how this project started to come together as a book? When did you start to conceptualize these case studies and this kind of very specific approach? You know, how did it start to come together for you?
Yeah, well, I have, you know, well, we as religionists, you know, folks who sit around thinking about method and theory in the study of religion, there has been a fair bit of reflection in our field around let's call it sort of the explanatory power of the normative paradigm. So how do we study religion would be the widest question, which would be narrowed down into questions like representation, right? So what are the authoritative voices? What are the defining boundaries, characteristics of a religious tradition that we are going to operate with when we sit down to think about religious phenomena in the world, right? So how do we come to our objects? And so do we defer as scholars to normative structures, right, that religious traditions present to us? Do we defer to those? Do we use the normative lens, right, as the authoritative focus, right, for our study of religion? That's a, you know, there are many ways that question has been advanced, but I think that's been a key move in the last, you know, in our generation. So one related issue, or sort of one way that question comes to light, right, is around the practice of religion. So things we used to call them popular practices of religion. We used to call them things like syncretic practices of religion. We used to say things like, you know, the small tradition versus, you know, the orthodox great tradition of Islam. So pretty quickly, right, we see that the history of religious, the history of the practice of Islam is so vast, so complex, so rich, that deferring to sort of normative lenses and normative structures, right, and normative authoritative narratives around religion as our lens, deferring to those doesn't help us, right? Or pretty quickly we see that we see the limitations of those normative models. So with that nuance in mind, I turned increasingly to focus, of course, in my area of interest, so Mamluk Egypt, and trying to take a, let's say, bottom up approach, as was the experiment, right? So the way I would pitch it to a publisher, right, would be to say, imagine you fell from the sky, from the moon, and you landed in Cairo in the middle of the 14th century. What would you see? Like, what would Islamic practice, what would religious practice look like? How would it present itself to you? Well, it would be a complicated picture. It would be full of images, bodies, objects, sacred space, right? The sensory, right? All of these things would be presenting themselves to you sort of from the ground up, or kind of the daily life perspective, right? Versus the model where we would have sort of authoritative abstractions about Islam, and then as historians walk out and try to find confirmation of those structures. So this is to start with the object, and the book, it ended up being useful, I found, to articulate and to underline what I've come to call the devotional impulse. Right, so this devotional impulse to capture the sort of visceral, sensory, grounded, embodied, daily, immediate practice and experience of Islam. So let's start with that. Let's start with that practice. Let's start with those objects. Let's start with that impulse, right? The devotional impulse. And then build out, and then tell the stories, and and then contextualize. So this approach, sort of starting with the objects, doesn't preclude. I mean, we end up, talking about Islamic law. You end up talking about theology. You talk about politics. You talk about history. You talk about, all of these substantial Islamic discourses. But starting with the object, starting with the daily life perspective, as a technique, as a method, took me to places that I think I wouldn't otherwise get to.
So one of the things I really loved about the book was you synthesize very clearly a lot of theoretical resources for the study of objects, material culture, visual culture, this kind of field. And you make some, what I think is very productive assertions from your own perspective. So could you talk us through some of the things that you think are perhaps hurdles to the study of material religion, and what are some productive ways to move forward as a kind of general ideas about aesthetics and visual culture, objects, these kind of things?
Sure. Yeah, and the book ended up being a wonderful platform for me for working out a lot of these methodological questions. And so my take, in the wake of these, the developments in the last 10 years, right, in the study of religion around material religion, I found the, as I mentioned earlier, sort of this idea of sort of starting with the objects. I found that to be helpful. And it was helpful because determined what the analytical possibilities and outcomes were going to be, but it started sort of starting with the object was useful because it would help shift the sort of analytical paradigm, right, for me as a researcher. So the questions that I had to ask once I have sort of followed the object, once I have started with the object, the subsequent questions that I, as an Islamicist, resort to are oftentimes a shift, right, or a reach, or some sort of a new focus compared to the way I would have normally approached the history of religion and the history of Islamic practice. So just starting with the object as a methodological step, in my experience, was helped me very much, and even I would say helped to shift the discursive paradigm, helped to shift the kinds of questions that I suddenly needed to ask. And another sort of takeaway I think from wrestling with this methodologically, for me, I had to sort of learn. I had to make room for how material religion operates as a analytical structure. It hinges on aesthetics in the sense that engagement with an object or image, right, is an embrace of the sort of unspoken communication, right, that an image or an object makes, right? I think that's a pretty go-to undisputed dimension of aesthetics, right? Like, I mean, what is the field of aesthetics? Well, aesthetics hinges on this understanding that, and this assumption, and this given that objects and images communicate, but they communicate in ways that are not reducible to language, right? And that's sort of the wonderful, fertile ground in the puzzle, right, of images and objects, and hence of aesthetics. But back to that methodological structure, right? So in my own work, what I had to sort of bring into focus was that, yes, starting with objects does shift your paradigm. Starting with objects and images does open you up to engaging around these phenomena of the unspoken communication of aesthetics that's at play. And then the third step there, right, is to say, well, now you still, as a researcher, have to wear your methodological hat. So you have to still complete that picture by being a phenomenologist, by being a comparativist, by being a historian describing a social history and social structure. We still, talking about material religion, starting with the objects doesn't preclude, it doesn't replace the methodologies that we use as religionists. It focuses, I think it frames the phenomena in wonderful ways that, right, approaching it as material religion, I think it gives us focus and a kind of a depth of focus, but we still have to bring to the table our own methodological approaches and structures and the strengths and weaknesses, right, of those methodologies. So sort of talking about the agency of the object, right, or in the book I talk about the scattering of object or the aesthetic resistance of an object. Those are sort of interesting things to focus on, right? Those phenomena around the objects, But like I say, just to repeat, it doesn't preclude the full-blown methodological structure that we as researchers must bring to the data, that we must bring to the phenomena.
Yeah, that's good. I think people that want to think about or approach Muslim societies in this way, I think your book would provide a nice entry point for them to kind of think about this in complex ways. So thanks for providing that kind of introduction in a way. But the examples you look at are really, really fascinating as well. And you start the book off looking at the Kaaba's ceremonial dressing and the processional sedan for its travels. Can you tell us a little bit about the life of the Kiswa and the Mahmil in Egyptian religious life and what the various movements of these objects reveal to us from your study?
Right. So, yes, right. So the book follows a series of objects, right? Again, sort of that imaginary, what would we see if we were standing, in the main thoroughfare of Cairo? What would we, what would be the sensory engagements as the practice of Islam? And right, so the first two chapters look at the mahmal and the Kiswa, right? So the Kiswa covering, the dress, right? This elaborately inscribed dress in the modern period, it's black for the Kaaba, right? And that dress had a rich ritual and devotional life. And so my focus in the Mamluk period just helps to bring out the depth and the this devotional life of the Kiswa or the dress of the Kaaba. The related object, right, is the mahmal. It's like the Arabic, the hawdaj, right, a carrier, right? Typically, well, normally of passengers, right? On the back of an animal, a camel. Now there this Hajj, part of the Hajj culture, part of the Hajj rituals and practices included the celebration of the mahmal. The mahmal would be sent out from various capitals in the Islamic world in the pre-modern, throughout the pre-modern period, and would accompany the pilgrim caravan on the Hajj. So the mahmal was this large, the English word palanquin, but this large, elaborately inscribed fabric. A structure that would travel on the back of a camel as part of the Hajj. So the chapter focuses on these objects and then sort of sets out to sort of tell their story, to chase down the religious discourses out of which they evolve, the rituals that they were involved in, the devotional resonance of these objects. That is how people in their daily, in their immediate environment related to these objects filled many pages and took several years to simply track down, to recover that story. And as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, this methodological question about authoritative and normative discourses, right, needing to be problematized by us as researchers. The interesting thing about the mahmal is that on the one hand, this work ended up showing this rich devotional life, this rich ritual life, this rich even political dimension of the mahmal in the lives of Kyrenes and many others, because you could send mahmals from other capitals. So it's just sort of the tip of the iceberg told in this book, the story of the mahmal. But that sort of dramatic history actually has a historical framework to it, and it's a 700-year period. So it's the middle of the 13th century to the middle of the 20th century was the period of the manufacturing and processing, parading of the mahmal, and then, as I said, this rich devotional life that it accrued. Back to that point about the deferring to the normative narratives, if we look at, I don't know, look in the Encyclopedia of Islam or look in some Aqidah articulation of basic Islamic beliefs and rituals, you're not going to find mahmals. You will find no mention of this practice. This long, rich Islamic practice will not appear in our textbooks. That is the textbooks of Islamic studies, and again, sort of our normative framework for the nature and the study of Islam. The mahmal will not appear. And so as a researcher, you're sort of flummoxed by that. How can this be such something that receives such a massive human input as an Islamic practice, as an expression of Islamic devotionalism, and it not appear in our sort of, you know, official history of Islam or even accountings of Islamic beliefs? Well, right. There's sort of a whole story to be told about that. But the methodological point is to say that there's all kinds of practices, conceptions, developments, right? Objects, material cultures, visual cultures that our methodological lenses can exclude from us, can hide from us, right? That hopefully, right, a shift in this case to material Islam, right, can shift our paradigm and can open up to us these otherwise occluded dimensions of Islam.
Yeah, I didn't really know much about this. I had seen a couple images, I think in either museum catalogs or kind of art history books, but I really hadn't heard much about this at all. And you continue the analysis of the mahmal around kind of what we would call mahmal related practices around tombs, funerary practices, and then ultimately it ends up in museums. You see these. So can you tell us a little bit about these kind of related practices? Where else does the mahmal show up? How are these practices understood or contested by Muslims, and ultimately how did it end up how did it come to be exhibited in the way it is?
Yes, so the sort of the biography of this devotional object, the biography of the mahmal, as I mentioned, spans basically 700 years, sort of the active public devotional life of this object. The banning of the end of the mahmal practice in Cairo, 1952, itself is an important part of the story, sort of the last chapter of this of the life of this object. Is a surprising and unexpected and in some ways a challenge to explain. So very briefly, with the rise, with the establishment of the power of the Saudis in Arabia, the control of the Haramain, and the rise of sort of Salafists friendly or oriented Islamic discourses in Egypt. So starting in the very end of the 19th century, and then up in the early part of the 20th century, contestation, right? Around what are licit Hajj practices, the public practice of Islam, what's the place of religion in the public square, what should Islamic practice be? And where does the government, where does political power, fit into this, fit into that equation? Yeah, these things, there's plenty of contestation. So the first part of the 20th century, right, the pendulum swings back and forth around practices like Sufism, right, and the Hajj rites and observances are also debated, and that's a rather, it's an interesting sort of prolonged several decades long discussions. Anyways, to jump to the end of it, the Mahmal and its related parading practices and its related Hajj culture comes to an end. The government decides that they are going to stop this practice. At first, they scale it down, but anyways, the decision is made finally to stop the public parading of the Mahmal in Cairo. And a dilemma presents itself, and the dilemma clearly is: what does one do? If we're conducting religious reform, what do we do with these objects? And it was not at all clear what to do with the Mahmal, right? Such a prominent and central iconic object of Hajj culture. And the upshot is, the answer is originally a colonial imposition, right? And there are kind of very negative ways we can tell the history of the museum in Egypt, right? With that colonial legacy and the frameworks for collecting and the rationale behind the museums in the Middle East is problematic. That becomes the space in which this object, the Mahmal, is sent, and there's this sense that this devotional Islamic object can be sort of contained, or can be, and in that sense, be neutralized. I'm not sure that's a good way to put it, but by this modern institution, the museum. And that was recently nationalized, right? At this point, so you have museums becoming a tool in Islamic religious reform.
So you move to another kind of interesting discussion about this tension between text, right? Written text and its legibility through these examples of banners. So what should we know about these various banners and their parading practices? Because that's also probably new to a lot of listeners. But then how does the visibly unread text operate? And then how does it resist the equation of its meaning with language, as you kind of discussed earlier in the book, this idea of resistance. So,
yeah, Right. So it's sort of in the heart of the book, I have a chapter on processions and banners. And this for me was, I just learned so much, so many lights, you know, sort of went off for me as I pursued in that chapter, which was the banner, right? So, right, we have all kinds of public display processions, right, related to Hajj practices, right, Hajj practices. And the more I dug around in that material, I could see that there really was something very significant and nuanced. It's sort of very multi-layered around banners, right? So sort of obvious questions start to present themselves, right? What does it mean to display, right, a banner, a religious banner? What, and then, you know, you just get more questions when you start to ask, put these objects into focus. Questions legibility, right? So how does a banner work as an object? Is a banner an image, or is a banner a text? Well, right. So the answer is it's both. It's legible. It's almost intentionally, however, illegible, right? Or difficult to read, or at least the legibility is not central to a religious banner, right? As a manuscript or in other inscriptions are. So how does that, you know, what does that mean for this object? What are these, you know, what are those observations telling us about religious banners and their use, right, in devotional life? Well, we have sort of these several layers of discursive communication, right, are at play. It becomes a very nuanced component, right, of the material and visual culture, right, of Islamic devotions, and in this case, around the display and movement, right, of banners. So especially, I mean, I just focused on the Sufi orders and their banners because they're ubiquitous in this period, and many banners, many Sufi parades, many Sufi orders. And so the chapter just tries to follow out some of these questions, right? So how do inscriptions operate on the aesthetic level? How do the non-discursive components of a banner communicate? How does this writing, this carried moving, right, these texts carried in the arms of humans, right, through a topography, how does that communicate aesthetically, right, into the Islamic devotional register? So yeah, these really tricky and ended up being sort of delightfully rich inquiries that followed this otherwise, you know, deceptively simple object that is the sort of humble banner of a religious procession.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to put it, because that seemed to be happening to me as a reader, you know, getting introduced to all these objects was, you know, they seem like, of course, just we can think of them in this simplistic way, but then all these further questions do open up. And this happens, of course, as you move on, you look at relics and objects of devotion. And one of the things that was really great about this chapter is you provide or establish a kind of relic typology in terms of kind of their function and purpose and how they relate to each other. So can you talk about the different types of relics that you, how you categorize them?
Yeah, right. So another object or a set of objects, yeah, right, is the relic. Something that, well, you know, just did not have a lot of scholarly research behind it. That is, of course, in our context of the Islamic world, in the study of Buddhism, you know, relics, there's plenty of work being done and all kinds of terrific theorizing. And then in the European context, relics and the work that's been done on them and in other traditions in other parts of the world. But for the Islamic world, relics, athar, or sometimes called mukhalafat, were widespread, easily recognized, celebrated objects. Again, important objects in the visual, material, devotional landscape, right, of Islam, with very little scholarly attention. And I think it's the first first edition of the Encyclopedia of Islam, if I'm not mistaken, this under athar or relics, I forget the entry, you look and you expect to find an article on relics, but you find simply one sentence, see Ibn Taymiyyah, right, is the encyclopedic entry. Right, Ibn Taymiyyah, also of the Mamluk period, but a great critic of popular Islamic practice, and himself a religious reformer. Islamic relics. So that history is just waiting to be, waiting to be explored. So I began with the typology, and I don't know if I have it off the top of my head to reproduce it, but I began to survey, of course, the ritual, the related ritual practices, but with my focus on aesthetic communication, I do engage with the material support of relics, right? So relics, yes, are images, but they are also this material, right? They are these material constructs, right? That are placed in the visual field. So what is the material support, and is that a useful way to start making sense of this wide variety? My typology ends up being a mix, and I hope I'm depending on other younger, more energetic scholars to pick up and challenge and to develop this typology further. But the categories that I'm proposing around to begin with are categories like bodily relics, right, which of course would be these parts of a human body, right? In Cairo, most prominent shrine arguably is one to a head relic, right, of Hussein, but all the way down to nail clippings and hairs of the Prophet, right? Another category is imprint relics. So the Islamic traditions recognition of and memorialization and ritual engagement with with imprints, right? And these are all the way from footprint relics. In Cairo itself, we have records of footprints of the Prophet, footprints of other prophets, footprints of various saintly figures. But more widely in the Islamic tradition, imprint relics relating to the earliest history of Islam. So in chasing down and trying to fill out this picture of imprint relics, I was it really brought into focus for me that the wealth of the richness of the devotional topography of Mecca and Medina in the pre-modern period, and imprint relics was a wonderful bridge into that sacred topography that was celebrated, written about plenty in across a variety of sources, that celebrated and engaged and would sort of tell the story of early Islamic history and the subsequent devotional posture, right, towards that history through sites, right? So through locations in Mecca and Medina. So here is Khadija's house, for example, and here is an imprint in stone where, you know, Muhammad sat. And then here is, you know, here's the mark on the floor where Hussein was born, and on. So these, this constituted another category that I provisionally call imprint relics. So sort of a whole series, really just me ending up trying to control what ended up being a surprisingly rich and varied field of visual and material culture that could fall arguably under this wide category of Islamic relics.
Yeah, and it's helpful. I think you do a good job of kind of looking at the various roles that these can play as well, and you kind of flesh this out in the following chapter that looks at relics both in their relationship to authority and then also their relationship to constructing or shaping religious landscapes. These are often combined. So could you talk a little bit about how relics are wielded by those in power and how they might be used to reconfigure religious topographies? Mm.
And yeah, I think this connection between devotional objects and topographies, I think, is a very very basic connection, right? I mean, we were tempted to think of aesthetic objects sort of pulled out of their environments. I mean, we're typically pretty comfortable, right, talking about the aesthetics of objects, you know, sort of floating in space, and that's, you know, there's a reason for that, but I think for this, for the study of religion, for the study of Islam, that, right, topography, right, evolving topography, the political and religious and devotional topographies, right, is the space, right, in which these objects live. It's the space in which these objects matter. It's the space that these objects illuminate, right, or inhabit, right, or traverse, or in which they, you know, connect various sites or various, you know, dots on the map, as it were. So I think relics, although yes, of course, these are movable objects, any movement they make, any position they have, is, you know, we're immediately talking about the topography. We're immediately talking about a religious landscape, right? In the world in which these objects live, and in which they make sense, and in which they, you know, live, have their careers as devotional objects. Yes, is the topography. So I start to write as a follow up on the typology of relics to talk about the religious typography. But there's so much to do. I was pretty quickly overwhelmed by that story. So we're talking about sacred space and we're talking about mapping. But it seemed to me pretty clearly an important place and a good place to start is around relics that relate to the central ritual rite of the Hajj, that relate to the prophet himself and to immediate followers. So this question of engineering a devotional landscapes through relics seemed to be a solid line to follow in that context. So I talk a bit in that chapter about the various plans to acquire relics and by usually caliphs, but others, to acquire relics as part of a campaign, as part of a strategy to engineer shrines, to constitute sacred space, right, in a particular religious and political topography. Al-Hakim is the sort of most dramatic figure, but there are plenty of others who understand how these, they have a very clear sense of how relics work, the central position of relics in devotional culture, and the sense that yes, shrines, shrines are built. So why not build our own? So whatever your political agenda is, your ideological agenda, or even your religious perspective, right, within the Islamic tradition, can be articulated and advanced through the creation of shrines and devotional spaces, and you generate those within these religious topographies. And a great way to do it, a very quick way to do it, is to mobilize relics. So maybe you try to, steal them, but you try to acquire them from Mecca and Medina. There's, of course, a whole market of relic trading that develops fairly early on. I mean, fairly early on, we have plenty of examples of the recognition and use and mobilization of relics for various purposes we go back to Hadith literature to uncover the early chapters of relic recognition and the sort of strategic use of relics as a tool within the Islamic toolbox, right, for engineering religious landscapes.
Now there's a lot to the book. We could talk for a lot more, but is there anything essential that you wanted to discuss before I let you go?
Well, I guess just to maybe round out the picture, we mentioned the role of the museum, right? This colonial institution, nationalized, but this colonial institution, as in the later chapters of the life of the Mahmal, at the end of the book, I am in the context sort of feeding off, following on relics and the creation of sacred space and topographies. I look at the use of spolia in, when I restrict myself to Mamluk and, well, Mamluk and Ottoman, but primarily Mamluk period Egypt, and the use of pharaonic spolia within, again, the religious landscape and within religious architecture. So it ended up there was a fairly sustained use of pharaonic objects, the recovered, chosen, presented building materials, right, that are clearly, that are inscribed and are and we can identify where they're from and, you know, and what the text says in them, of these pharaonic spolia into especially Mamluk buildings, and I'm focusing on religious buildings, and from a again back to the sort of methodological shifting the methodological focus, they're a bit dissonant phenomena, right? Why would you as a Muslim patron, I guess, or a builder, choose pharaonic spolia and present them in these obviously carefully chosen displays. I don't mean just, you know, sort of tearing down blocks, you know, from a pyramid to use in the foundation of a wall. I mean cartouches, right? Figural representations, text from pharaonic materials that was presented, that was chosen. So why, right? And I'm presenting this as in the book, right, really as this little case study, right, to say, well, here is where, right, these framing around aesthetic is helpful to bring these objects and these practices and this discursive communication, what's signaled, right, by these objects, by these images, by these inscriptions. My argument is that the aesthetic framework and questions, right, can help us get traction on what might otherwise be a pretty puzzling, you know, phenomena. It seems like a cultural disconnect, right? Why would one, you know, why would medieval Muslims draw on these pharaonic objects? And right, so I recover some of that history and trace down some of these objects. And so to bring it back up to this the colonial period, that story ends at least for my work, it ends right. So this practice of the incorporation of pharaonic spolia in Islamic architecture, in a sense, ends or is at least deeply disrupted. By the intervention, not so much of an Islamic religious reform, but of a colonial intervention. So while the French and British were building, you know, museums, they were also intervening directly into the built environment. They were intervening into the visual field of Islamic religious spaces, and they were intervening with this logic that of purification, right? So the French would come and say, well, this has a pharaonic cartouche, right, in your zawiya, and this must be ripped, torn out, and we must put it in the Louvre, and the British were doing, you know, their share of what they thought were sort of purifying or untangling, you know, this complex visual culture that they found in the built environment and intervened in many places to. Like I say, a violent intervention to untangle, right, and disassociate the Islamic from the Quranic in the categories that made sense, that made sense to them. So these lives, right, of objects are long, right, and complex, and sometimes with surprise endings.
Yeah, well, it's a really great book and an interesting take, and I hope people will follow in your footsteps and pursue this type of approach moving forward. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of the things you've perhaps been working on or that you have planned in the future.
Sure. Several avenues, open up. That's the thing about, writing a book. You just come out with, half a dozen book proposals after finishing your book, which is great. So certainly on relics, I think just as a category, we as religionists, those of us who work in, Sufism, Islamic theology, those of us who are interested in ritual, relics, I think are a wonderful puzzle waiting to be explored and will reward us if we sort of embrace them. But then also from the material side, so are people interested in material culture per se, so sort of the more art historical, archaeological approaches, can also join these discussions. And I think focusing on the material and visual helps to sort of widen the tent, of research and discussion. So for me, relics seems to have a sort of wide resonance that I'm hoping to build out. I'm starting out on a project that's relating to, we spoke earlier about the sort of puzzle that is the Islamic banner, right? The moving text, right? The sort of illegible image that is the inscribed banner, and with all of its performative communication. Some of that has pushed me to set out to explore what I think will reward more attention is the sensory devotional resonance of manuscript material in pre-modern Islamic practice. So things like marginalia, things like scratches, things like rubbings on manuscript, these sort of forms of intertextuality, this visceral embodied impact and interaction with devotional Islamic texts is something that I'm embarking upon. So that's going to take some refining of how I'm going to approach that around method and theory, but at the same time, it should allow me a focus to go back into this vast, very lightly studied treasure trove that we have of devotional manuscripts, right, in the Islamic tradition, right? These very important texts that we have not been able to appreciate as a field with our assumptions around Islamic theology, Islamic practice, normative practice, the word, right, the book, orality. So hopefully this focus on the embodied visceral interaction with devotional texts will allow me a little bit of a toehold into this significant and definitely understudied body of Islamic literature. We can just sort of call the devotional literature widely conceived.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of work ahead of you, Richard. I wish you the best of luck.
I'll need it. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for taking time to talk about this wonderful book.
Great. Well, Christian, it's been my pleasure. And I'd also like to thank you for hosting, but thank you for all your work in these many wonderful interviews that you have made available to the field. It's just an amazing service and many gifts that you have just sent out into the world through your intrepid work on this platform. So
well, thanks.
For many people will join me in thanking you also.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, we have a good team now, and we will continue doing the good work.
Terrific.
That was my conversation with Richard McGregor on Islam and the Devotional Object, Seeing Religion in Egypt and Syria, published with Cambridge University Press in 2020. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.